Hello and welcome to another episode of Juicebox Music Podcast. I'm your host, Hunter McClamrock, and with me on the other line, some poor sucker at the bottom of a lake, it's Nick Moreau. What's up, Nick?
Wow, that escalated quickly.
You know, I went dark today. I don't know.
That's very dark, yeah. Won't think about the insults you just raged on me, but
maybe it's the beginning of fall. You know, it has me. We're already creeping into Halloween mode. And some of these records we're listening to put me in this mood, Nick.
That's a good point. But you live in Southern California, where you're still in summer and will be for the next 3 years.
I was defiant today, and I put on a pair of pants. You know, long pants. Oh.
A little nippy, weather, a little cold, 72 degrees.
I can will it into happening at least.
Yeah. Well, I don't blame you. It's 83 here, so you know, it's nice and warm. But you are right. These it does start to feel like fall. This slate of records, where we are in the year, we're nearing the end of the year and starting to think about our top 10. I was asked last night when we were going to release our top 10, and I had. I kind of did a double take and checked my calendar. So I guess we are in September.
It's not time yet. I am a big proponent of not putting out, publications will start putting out top 10s at the end of November when there's still a whole month's worth of releases to come out.
Yeah. And then you end up forgetting about some records.
So don't just wait till January, people. Come on.
Yeah.
I know people have a lot of dead time at the end of the year, so they probably just, they have time to read lists and things like that. But, it's never a complete picture.
Agreed.
So here we are. We told you we'd be back without delay. We're getting back into it, cracking our knuckles, opening our ear holes for all that's happening this fall. Few records to talk about, since the beginning of September, we caught up on all the August releases on the last show. So what's the thing that stood out to you the most this September, Nick?
I would have to call out the debut album from the French duo that we spoke about since Primavera called The Blaze. And they released their first LP called Dance Hall earlier this month. And then you got a chance to check them out at Primavera earlier this summer, and kind of turned me on to them, and I've been following them since. And this LP just released, and I have to say, it's a great listen. I'm listening to it a lot. Have you checked it out yet?
Yeah, it's crazy how far their profile has come since earlier this year. I mean, I had not even heard of this group until a friend of mine at Primavera said that I should come check it out, and I'm really glad I did. It was a really memorable set at the festival, and then it seems like that momentum has been building for this group ever since, and they make really, really great music videos.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of their appeal, these complete epic videos that in today's world can get them a lot of attention online. I have to say, I'm more of a fan of the singles and the videos than I am the album experience from The Blaze.
I would agree. I would agree with that.
Yeah. They're kind of a modern group in that sense where, maybe the album, although the album is an easy listen. It's, I think, only 38 minutes long or so. I don't think it's representative of them as at least the live act that I saw, and doesn't have like the kind of concise punch of seeing the music video of theirs with the song kind of syncing perfectly with the image.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would agree, but it doesn't mean that, like, I still enjoy listening to this album a lot. Back to to your point that it's a very easy album to listen to. Mm-hmm. I think there's a few standouts on the album, but I agree that their previous EP was basically every song was great. It was just like six singles and it was great. Here, I think there's like four or five, standouts, but really two of them I listened to over and over. I will say, back to the video thing, this is a band from France, two cousins, I believe. And one of them, directs all the music videos. He went to film school and does all the music videos. So kind of a little more on the video side. You know, it almost feels like a band that's like an audio video production in a way. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious to see them live. I don't know if I'll be able to catch them on this U.S. leg that they have coming up. But I did have a question for you. Do they, you know, it seems like the vocals for all the songs are the same. Do they have somebody singing on stage, or do they just, are they just DJing?
Yeah, they have singing on stage, live singing. And the vocals, I wanted to talk to you about the sound of these vocals. It's kind of this, they're very like mournful, sad kind of processed vocals, which, you know, I think we might come into play later with some of the other records we talk about. But it seems that they have, there's kind of a formula for these songs that makes it a little more obvious when you hear so many of them in a row. And it, you know, I got the feeling that this record might, they were building so much momentum and on behalf of their live shows and some of their videos. And I wondered if maybe this record was a little bit rushed and they weren't able to branch out in certain ways and have kind of the warmth that I saw from their live show. Is there's none of that translates. It's a very cold record, even though it is fun to listen to. And I agree with you. It's not like it's, you put it, something to put on around the house. You know, I think I've forgotten how to cook lately, so I've got a whole lot of cooking records to catch up on. But, you know, I could see how it would be good in that context.
Yeah. I think, I didn't think about that. I think you might be right. I also think, you know, what made the EP so good is that yet you did have some songs with those vocals, but out of the six songs, you also had two songs that didn't have vocals. And I think it actually helps to let the record breathe. Because mm-hmm. I do think that the voice effect after five or six songs in a row, I don't want to say it gets old, but it just, it's maybe a little too much, you know, a person can only listen to so much mournful vocals unless you're, I guess, listening to Radiohead.
but there's a lot of, the difference, Tom York's range is really mm-hmm. dynamic, whereas these vocals kind of stay in the same general key for most of the songs. It had me like wishing they had some guest vocalists on the album.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I talked about a couple, standouts. I'll just name two. I think mm-hmm. Heaven, which was the first single off the album.
Yeah.
That's a great song. The music video that goes with it is just, you know, just makes me smile every time I see it. And I will say, you know, that single feels like it was recorded in the same time that, you know, the Territory EP was recorded. It just feels very linked to that to me. Mm-hmm. And maybe because the video kind of seems like it's directly taken from, you know, that time they were recording. And then the sixth track, Runaway, I think is really good. That's a really good track that I think will have a lot of festival energy, you know, when they do and undoubtedly play festivals coming up here. And then the song right after that, Breathe, is also, I would say, a standout for me for this album.
I really like the song Faces towards mm-hmm. the end. I think that's probably my favorite, but I agree with you about Heaven. And Faces is a little bit more of a little bit less bombastic of a song, I guess, mm-hmm. on the album.
Yeah.
I think I'm definitely curious about where they go from here. Like I said, I think there was a little bit, maybe I'm reading into it a little bit, but it felt a little rushed. And I think, you know, if they come back with something that is a little more adventurous, I would even say a longer, more exploratory record, but that's just what I'm looking for. I'm sure there's a lot of bangers on this that I think are going to translate really well to a festival crowd. I've seen it happen before.
Yeah,
festival season now.
Yeah, I don't think it's a collection of what could have been several singles.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's like an album, if you will.
And they have such an aesthetic beyond, beyond a music, like a very defined musical aesthetic at this point. And, and with all of their album covers and videos and everything, it makes them into this really unique package.
Yeah.
I'm worried. I don't want them to like go the way of Disclosure and kind of keep repeating the same thing to where, you know, Disclosure was basically playing arenas and then now are sort of an afterthought in just a year or two.
Yeah, it's crazy. I haven't thought about Disclosure in forever. They even had that. Didn't they have that? They even went to like you had that Facebook add-on where you could make your profile picture like the Disclosure face.
Oh wow!
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were. That was one of the most, one of the swiftest kind of rises and falls of a group in recent years, and one that doesn't get enough attention. Hey, maybe Disclosure will be back at some point. Who knows?
Yeah, didn't they play Wembley?
They were huge, man, and they were basically responsible for Sam Smith becoming like a megastar.
Yeah,
but I think he's going to outlast them for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
Yes, I would. I mean, I'm curious to see The Blaze again live. I think the songs will make for a really fun live experience. You know, a lot of the music that, especially, I don't know, this month, a lot of the music that we're talking about on this show feels super contextual to me. Like, listening to it in the right place in the right time is important.
Mm. Yeah.
And this is just one of those records. Yeah. So that's Dance Hall by Blaze. So they're cousins. I wasn't sure if they're cousins, brothers. I think they have the same last name.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe they're cousins.
Are they your cousins?
Don't tell people. I guess somewhere down the line. I don't know.
Yeah, all French people are related somehow, huh?
Just like Icelandic people.
How do they make so many of you?
You know, they have that app in Iceland that will tell you, like, I read an article about it. If you're single and you're going to a bar and you meet someone and you can put in their name in an app and it tells you the percent chance that they're related to you.
Ooh.
Because there's so few people that there's a lot of there's been a lot of cousin.
Well, what percentage is too high? Is there is there a law about that, or is it just kind of a cultural thing that you got to feel out?
I think it's just how you feel. Is like I'm a kind of a, you know, I don't know. Are you like a 5% guy?
Albert Einstein married his first cousin, and I heard he was pretty smart. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe he wasn't street smart.
I guess not. He didn't know the ways. I don't know what those streets are like, but.
All right. Well, this podcast, please follow our sister podcast called Incest Box. All right.
Anyhow, another band. Well, I was going to another band that it has, close relations within the group is Low, who have been, you know, on the indie rock scene since the early 90s, and have come back with an album that's getting a lot of attention for them called Double Negative. This is a band from Duluth, Minnesota. You know, there's a lot of things about this band that has stood out as unique over the course of their career. They're from, you know, Duluth, Minnesota. The lineup is mostly consisted of a husband and wife, Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker. And, you know, they are members of the Latter-day Saints, the couple. So, you know, that's a unique thing in the hard drinking, hard living world of indie rock touring, I'm sure. And they're back, you know, a lot of people associate them with the genre slow core, which I always think about in the same way I think about shoegaze. It's one of those genres that all the artists that are associated with them don't want, although there's a lot of, I think, modern younger bands who like to call themselves shoegazers in the same way. Mm-hmm. Some bands have embraced the term emo even. And you know, did you ever listen to Low? Were you a fan of any of their previous records?
My introduction to Low, you know, I can't say I'm a big fan, but it was on Come On, their 2011 record.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. Okay. And then I kind of just didn't really listen to the next two they put out, The Invisible Way and Ones and Sixes. But I was very curious about Double Negative. I think, you know, you mentioned that it was getting a lot of attention, not only from the press, but from other artists. I saw some people just talking about it. And so, you know, I gave it another chance, and I have to say, I am very in love with this record.
It's, you know, they're kind of a band that's been around for a while, and I feel like they kind of dip into a more mainstream consciousness every, I don't know, four records or so. There was a time, the first album I actually ever heard by them was Drums and Guns, which was in 2007. And they had the Great Destroyer before that, which was also, you know, kind of one of their bigger records. Drums and Guns had, lyrically, had dealt a lot with the Iraq War and the fall, the blowback from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've kind of chugged along, and I haven't really checked in on them very much since then. And, it, you know, I put on, I was like, oh, I wanted to see what Low sounds like now. I heard it was, you know, a little bit of a radical departure for them. And I put on this record, and it took me three times just to get through the first song, because I thought my speakers were malfunctioning the first time.
And that's so funny you said that. Keep going. Sorry.
Well, I thought my speakers were malfunctioning the first time. And I there's people over in my house. I didn't really feel like, you know, digging into it too much. I turned the music off and, you know, went back to something else. And the second time, I said, okay, maybe this is what the album actually sounds like. And I'm missing something here. I need to, you know, try this with headphones. So then I went back to it with headphones, got through the whole thing, found out, like, after the first few songs, there really start to be some songs on this album. But when you talk about, like, burying the melody, or, you know, the melody is straight up buried on some of these songs. And I mean, literally, like, the it's fading in and out. You're and it's, you know, creating this whole kind of sensibility that the music is trying to run away from you, or in my case, that my speakers are just going in and out. Mm-hmm. Listen to it once, and was somehow compelled to listen to it again right away. And I'm really glad I did that, because the album is such a grower, but there's some really beautiful songs on here.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that I've had an album that is, it's hard for me to describe it. So back to your previous point. So my first time listening to this album, I was like, is this Low? I don't remember Low sounding like this at all.
Yeah, they're kind of known for the minimal songs with, you know, slow pace, acoustic instruments, guitar. Mm-hmm. I should say analog instruments, guitar, bass, very minimal drums, and the vocals of Alan and Mimi going back and forth.
Yeah, and this is more like there's some more ambient sounds. It feels a little more like layered almost. Mm-hmm. But you know, when I listen to it, it's not an immediate album, but I was immediately drawn to certain songs that I listened to over and over. I think I listened to Dancing in Blood like twice a day still. and I listen to the album pretty regularly, but that one I really, really like. And now this was a big surprise, because I wouldn't have checked it out unless I saw, you know, some of the artists that I mentioned earlier that talked about it. And I was like, oh, wow, this album's getting a lot of love. Let me give it a chance. And very pleasantly surprised on this one.
Yeah, there's a few songs on here. Always Trying to Work It Out for me is pretty amazing. Poor Sucker, which I referenced earlier in the podcast. And that last song, Disarray, is unbelievably beautiful, I think. I didn't know how much they had been incorporating electronic instruments into their sound over the past few albums. I've heard apparently they have, but this is kind of a much bolder step with those. And, you know, I mean, it can't help but remind me a little bit of Radiohead and Kid A.
Right.
They have toured with Radiohead, I think, on several occasions throughout their history. I know I saw them open for Radiohead at Madison Square Garden, maybe in the first part of the 2000s. So And it was, and I have to say, it was, it, they were not the kind of band that played to a room like Madison Square Garden very easily. It, you know, they spent a lot of their career kind of with opening for artists or early on in their career before people were coming to see them, specifically with the audience kind of talking over them and that maybe the hum from the crowd being louder than the actual music.
Yeah. So yeah, that would be a weird place to see Low.
Right. But I think this is, I mean, this record's going to be great for them, and they're going to have a great touring cycle, you know, on the back of a really strong album, and maybe win over some more fans for them. Definitely keep all the ones that they have, even though it's kind of like a little bit of a left turn for the band. I can't imagine them losing fans over this.
Yeah.
This changes yeah. them.
I would agree. It feels like a pretty, like it feels like a critical darling as well as a, you know, it's that sweet spot of like critics love it, fans I think will love it, and it'll attract new fans.
And from what I know about Low and the music I've heard from them, it still sounds like Low to me. Just instrumentation is different. Some of the ideas are different. It sounds like a band, you know, that's still growing. What are we, like 25 years after their first album? In a way, maybe, like we talked about the Interpol record last week, maybe that band is not necessarily growing so much as they're honing a sound that they have. Low still, you know, has the adventurousness and maybe the trust within the band, and it, you know, it's a married couple with a couple of children and a revolving bass player really throughout the years. So there's a lot of trust built up in there to kind of do something like this when, you know, most bands wouldn't at this stage in their career.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I'm interested to see this album live, to be honest. I don't know if you're going to try to check it out.
Yeah. I think I was thinking about that too. You know, I've probably had a lot of opportunities to see Low throughout the years, and I'm definitely more interested in seeing them now than ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. It just feels like this gets a note of approval from the Juicebox crew.
Definitely. You know, I was a few days ago before when I was first listening to it, I was all fired up to come in here and take down this critical darling of a record.
Yeah, because I was like, have you listened to the album yet? Have you listened to Low yet?
And it crept up on me, and, you know, I'm going to keep listening to it a lot more. Yeah. And I'm glad that I explored it beyond just thinking that my speakers were broken.
Yeah.
I could not have taken a full album like the first two songs, though. Like, they're kind of fading in and out of vocals. It was driving me kind of crazy at first, but there is, like any Low album, there is beauty, a lot of beauty buried underneath. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you checked it. You gave it, you know, its due, and you like it. Because, I really like this album. I think, you know, this is another great album to just, you know, spend some alone time walking on the beach, think about things.
What about, are you doing some flying soon, Nick?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Could it be a possible plane pick?
You know, that's a great call. I'm going to try that. I do have a plane pick for you, though. This is a good segue. I know you've already talked about it as a great album. But speaking of albums I want to try on a plane, the new Spiritualized album.
Yeah, we teased this on last week's show. I mentioned how I thought And Nothing Hurt, the latest from Jason Pierce and Spiritualized, was a great plane album. And I maintain that. The first time I heard it was actually on a plane.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try that tomorrow. I'll give you my verdict to see if it's a great plane album. I will tell you, though, it is a great Spiritualized album.
And I agree with you on that front.
I think it's the best Spiritualized album since Ladies and Gentlemen, We Are Floating in Space.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. You know, and that was an album that, you know, I think NME ranked it above OK Computer and is it Urban Hymns from The Verve that mm-hmm. year. So I think it won Album of the Year from NME.
The summer of 97 was a crazy time.
Yep. Yep. I was 11, smoking cigarettes in the woods. It was great. But no, the I mean, I think I, from the first listen, this just feels like such a great, just a true spiritualized album. I didn't really care as much for the last two. And I just think this one is a return to form for 53-year-old Jason Pierce.
But I'd say, you know, just bringing up the other records that came out in 1997, like spiritualized, you know, they sort of felt like a band of the time. He was in psychedelic rock band Spaceman 3. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Urban Hymns, of course, is the famously came out the same summer as this record. You know, Jason Pierce's girlfriend leaving him for Richard Ashcroft of The Verve, who was writing, you know, an album with a lot of really happy songs on it, whereas Jason Pierce comes out with Ladies and Gentlemen, We Are Floating in Space, which is mostly about that breakup and about drugs. And that also, that summer we had Be Here Now by Oasis, their third release, The Fat of the Land from The Prodigy. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember that summer very well. And it's funny thinking about those albums. I never could get into the spiritualized one, and you know, Oasis was good. It was bombastic. I could get into OK Computer because it was sort of sci-fi, but I think I was honestly just too young to understand the spiritualized album and kind of the emotional depth of it. And it wasn't until it's a young man. It's an older man's album. It's hard for like such a youngster to get into something like that.
I didn't listen to it until probably 2005 or six.
Yeah.
So, I know I wouldn't have liked it then because there was OK Computer. So, but my wife's, one of her favorite songs is the self-titled song from that album.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where like we went to go see Spiritualized so she could see that song.
And did you see them on the tour that they did playing the full album?
No, because I saw them on Sweetheart, Sweet Light.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not play that song. And my wife was very disappointed. And yeah. But anyway, having listened, around 2006, 2007, when I listened to that album for the first time, it was, I loved it immediately. And I think it's one of my favorite albums that I have in my record collection. And this And Nothing Hurts feels like the first true spiritualized album since. And I mean that in the sense that it feels like an album.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that songs in A&E or Sweetheart, Sweet Light felt like there were some great songs on them. But it was kind of hit or miss. And this feels, I can't tell when it starts and when it ends, if that makes sense. When the album, it just feels like one big song that is just amazing.
And it's funny too that the sound, remains so constant. He apparently had a much smaller recording budget for this album. I think he started sessions for one album and kind of scrapped it and didn't have as much money left over, so did most of the recording for this one on his own at his house. Because a lot of times spiritualized albums are kind of expensive affairs. You know, there's orchestras and choirs and all sorts of things that, that are part of his vision for this music. And, Ladies and Gentlemen, I got to see, they played that album in full. It was the first ever show at the Ace Hotel here in downtown LA on Valentine's Day, 2014.
Humble brag right there.
Got to go to that show. And that, that album, I kind of like Low, spiritualized, been around for a while. Really, like, I can't point to any of their work and say that it's like a notable dip in quality. But I sort of take them for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into these albums, without that much interest and sometimes, and I'm always impressed by how good of a songwriter Jason Pierce is. Mm-hmm. Like, when I think of spiritualized, I think more of like the sound with this kind of psychedelic with kind of soul elements to it and a lot of kind of bombast. But I sometimes forget how good like the actual songs themselves are and how good of a songwriter he is. And it's in full effect on this album. I agree with you for sure. And definitely, I think their best record in a few. Yeah, I would agree. Like maybe I really liked, you know, I think it was Amazing Grace, the one in 2003, and Songs and A&E. I think that was about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, that's crazy to think that was about 10 years ago.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, this is very different than that Low album, but what makes them both a good plain album? I mean, this, there's a plaintive element to this record. Like you kind of, he's sort of talking straight into your soul on some of these songs.
Yeah.
And even though it does get loud and kind of crazy on some of the songs, it is sort of soothing at the same time.
And I think maybe this is wrong, but I get there's a sense of loneliness in both of them.
Definitely.
And I know that when I'm on a plane, I just want to be left the fuck alone. So maybe that's why I find great plain albums to be more like meditative and like introspective, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think this is going to be a great plain album come tomorrow. Yeah, I'm excited to check it out on the plane.
And I think it's a very accessible album too. I mean, most of these songs have pretty solid hooks in them. The instrumentation is really fantastic. The sound is huge, and it sounds just as big as any of the other Spiritualized albums, some of which were recorded in like big studios with tons of musicians, in my opinion. I'm really impressed with what he was able to pull off on this album. But like you said, the loneliness thing is true. I mean, that maybe has something to do with it. When I listen to Spiritualized and his voice sometimes, I just want to like buy him a beer and put my arm around him. He sounds just so sad and lonely so much of the time.
I agree. I mean, isn't it, it's the kind of album, like if you go on your walk to Griffith Park, like you listen to, you're alone, walking up the hill. That's the kind of album that Spiritualizes to me, or this album is. So, yeah, that's why I think on the plane it's going to be awesome. I would like to buy him a beer though.
Yeah, just make sure everything's, you know, okay with the guy.
Yeah. No. Are you okay?
But it, you know, if he was okay, he wouldn't be putting out this much good music. So, another great Spiritualized album. I think. I know anybody who's a fan of the band, the friends I know who really like Spiritualized are on board with this one. And I don't think it's going to disappoint anybody.
No. It definitely feels like a Spiritualized album.
Yeah. So, excited. They're touring a little bit too, just a little bit in the US. They'll be in Los Angeles this fall. Yeah. They're always really great. I'm not sure what kind of band he's got on the road with this one, if there's, you know, going to be a 40-piece orchestra or something, I would probably reckon not, but you never know.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I think we saw them on the same tour, and I had a very different experience than you did, and you saw them twice, right, within that span, but when I saw them, first of all, the room was rather empty.
Really?
It was quite surprising. I was in the third row, standing.
So it was a standing venue. It wasn't a seated venue.
It was a standing venue, and he was seated the whole time.
Yeah, he does that.
But it wasn't. It was weird. He played a lot of the songs that he didn't play any of the songs you would have thought he played, and a lot of it felt like 10 minute versions of those songs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what it's always is, but I have to say, like, I didn't really love it.
Yeah, he's been known to stretch things out a little bit live, and I think that's something when I think about Spiritualized and the sound in their head, I think of everything being these epics. But then I go and put on the records, like this record, and there's like a 7 or 8 minute song towards the end of the album. But for the most part, they're all really concise, and like that's what I was saying when I forget like how impressive of a songwriter he is, and it's not just like freak out psychedelic jams, you know, like these are he's like a classic British songwriter to me.
Yeah.
But I don't think his songs are easily coverable. You know, it's hard to imagine other artists interpreting these songs anywhere on his level, but I wouldn't mind trying to hear somebody try at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, I agree. Yeah. I guess I didn't really expect the 10-minute versions of the 4-minute songs I love. and I know my wife, for example, did not enjoy that.
Yeah. So you're just trying to hear as many of the songs that you want to hear packed in at once.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll never forget Deer Hunter playing Nothing Ever Matters for like 45 minutes at one show. And that being one of two songs they played that night. Before abruptly ending the show early.
Well, Deer Hunter, you know, at this point, Bradford Cox, I'm up for anything.
Yeah.
I'm up for anything.
Anything. I think new music might be coming soon from them. I think so too. Rumblings throughout the mill.
I think so too.
Well, talking about Jason Pierce, you know, thinking about the summer of 97, all those great British albums that came out towards the end of the 90s. Sounds like it might be another episode of Hunter's Britpop Corner coming up right here, Nick.
Oh,
I think I need a theme song for this.
Oh, have you picked one?
No, but, you know, anybody has any theme songs? Anybody wants to write a theme song for Hunter's Britpop Corner? You can call me Mr. NME. I'm here to tell you. There was a new release this week that might be of interest to some of you. Now, Nick, when I was growing up, there were four bands that I had a personal Mount Rushmore of my favorite bands. All right. That was,
okay.
You know, I'm a kid. So, you know, I don't understand everything yet. And making some things like that aforementioned Spiritualized album kind of hard to get into, but you know, my favorite bands were Oasis, not in order. These are just the four. Manic Street Preachers, who I did another Britpop Corner earlier this year with their solid new album, Resistance is Futile.
Mm-hmm.
Radiohead, all right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth band, maybe the band credited with starting the whole Britpop phenomenon, Suede, all right?
I think it's the London Suede.
For you U.S. listeners, they are called the London Suede, and you know, there was a copyright thing where they had to change the name in the U.S. And, you know, singer Brett Anderson has basically said that that's part of the reason they never really gave the States that much of a shot. they hated being called the London Suede so much. They played Coachella a few years ago on behalf of one of their comeback, this is the third of their comeback records so far, but that's the only date they've played in the U.S. in decades.
Why is it a comeback record?
Well, they had basically a break, or they broke up after A New Morning, which is really, I mean, not only is it their worst record, but it's kind of an indefensible album with how bad it is. You can tell they were kind of checked out. I think there were some substance abuse issues happening within the band, and then it kind of petered out. Brett Anderson recorded some, you know, solidly crafted but pretty dull solo records before getting basically this is Suede had two versions, one with the first guitarist and one with the second. You know, they were one of the first bands ever, I think, to get, you know, somebody like in a cover band of theirs to actually join the band. So there, once Brett Butler or Bernard Butler, who was their original lead guitarist genius, left the band, they got a 17-year-old kid who was like a guitar prodigy and played covers of their songs to join the band. And he's been in the band ever since.
Wow.
That's Richard Oakes. And Bernard Butler was a guitarist from the first two records, gone on to be a great producer, produced that QTY record that we really liked several months ago.
Another example of an album that was released late in the year that publications missed because they published their top 10.
Totally. That came out in the last couple of weeks of last year.
Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
So Suede, you know, maybe it's been about, they reformed in probably the early part of this decade, maybe 2012 or 13. put out two records so far, Blood Sports and that other one, and and are now on the third record, and it's called The Blue Hour, came out this last week. It's, you know, their whole reformation has been really, really strong. I think, you know, all the fan base was really surprised by how good Blood Sports was. Oh, yeah, the album following Night Thoughts, which continued on, like, a little bit darker, but just kind of the quality. Suede are just like Interpol. They're a legacy band. You kind of know what you're getting into with their sound. The new one is a little bit more ambitious, though. It's a little bit, like, less of a back-to-basics Suede album with some, you know, to call them, like, over-the-top or overblown is kind of, I mean, there's really no point in saying that, because that's the whole point of of them as a band. You know, they're the glammiest, the sort of the gothiest, the most overwrought of all of the Britpop bands. And even though they had the biggest hits after their first guitarist left with some of their, like, really poppy, sizzling songs off of Coming Up, like Trash and The Beautiful Ones, you know, they always had this piano-driven ballad side that is kind of more in line with what you're getting on this album. A little bit more adventurous for Suede. I would say I need a little bit more time with it. It just came out this past week. But, I think it's another strong effort in their catalog. And they've really only put out that one kind of really bad record, which everybody from the band to anybody in their fan base, you know, I just realized I don't think Suede fans have a name, and they really should at this point, you know,
the Suedettes,
something like that. You know, this fan base is not getting any bigger right now, but, I'm definitely a member. I've got an old signed Suede poster here in my office for the Metal Mickey single, 1992, 1993.
That's right. You do have that awesome poster.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, a Mount Rushmore band for me. Not, you know, this isn't going to be anywhere close to my favorite album of the year or anything like that. But I'm still glad to have them kicking. And Brett Anderson actually has an autobiography. I think it's already been released in the UK and it'll be published here in the States this fall, called Coal Black Mornings. So I'll probably check that out.
Very cool. Well, I always enjoy Hunter's Britpop Corner. I will say, I'll reiterate, you know, if you have any songs that you, or snippets of songs you think we should use as an intro music for that corner, would be great. Would be even better is if you wrote one for us.
Yeah. We're taking all ideas for theme songs for the show, whether my Britpop corner or the show itself.
Yeah. So, get to your laptops and your synthesizers and your little guitars and make us a little theme song.
And if you've never heard Suede, definitely go back and listen to, at least check out their first two records. Both, I think, are masterpieces, the self-titled debut album and the second record, Dogman Star, which Bernard Butler actually, I think, quit the band during the making of, but is full of his incredible guitar playing on those first two records. And the first album has, like, the album cover are two very androgynous young humans kissing each other. You can't really tell if they're male or female. And I had the giant poster of that up on my wall growing up that, you know, I have to thank my parents for never telling me to take it down. They were a little disturbed by it at times, I think, but they let me keep it up. So kudos to them for that.
Do you still have it?
I don't still have that poster, no. No, I wish I did.
Should have framed that one.
That was before I knew. I think either push pins or whatever that sticky stuff that looks like chewing gum is that you can put posters
on. Oh, right. You can't get it off the poster, though.
No. It leaves a little bit of, like, grease behind.
Yeah.
But I was young then. That's been the theme of this podcast, I think. Yeah. Also, I was way too young to know half of what Brett Anderson was singing about on those early records. Well, it was like college age I started like, I was like, what is going on here?
So this is a question I had for you. Do you think, so if people who are younger, let's say early 20s, are listening to this right now, and they listen to early Suede, what do you think the early 20s of today think about that early Suede record?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it falls into a line of like introspective but glammy British guitar rock. In, you know, they were like, there was Bowie, and then there was the Smiths in the 80s, and then there was Suede in the 90s. But they definitely don't have the same cult-like status outside of the UK and in Europe, like you know, either of those other groups do. But I think they would hold up well. I just don't, they've never been kind of a hipster darling or anything like that. So, and I'm not sure what, you know, is stopping that. I think it might be just, there is a lack of humor with them. Well, a lack of obvious humor with them that, you know, I think the humor in Morrissey's lyrics sort of help that band get seen as something more than kind of this overwrought theatrical glam band, like, which I think Suede gets kind of pigeoned with. But they had a lot of fun on some of their songs too, and memorable lyrics, great melodies. But yeah, I think kids of today would dig them if they gave them a chance, especially if they thought about them in that context.
All right, kids, get to your turntables, put on some Suede.
Children, do it.
Yeah.
Look how I turned out.
Perfectly fine.
Well, Nick, awesome. there's more great records to talk about, but I think we're gonna leave this one where it is and get back to you guys sooner than ever.
Yeah.
Got some good interviews coming up soon. You're gonna get on iTunes, you're gonna get on Stitcher. Going to give us those ratings. You're going to subscribe your friends, your coworkers, your loved ones.
You know, I did that.
You did it.
I took one of my coworkers' friends and subscribed and gave a 5-star review for that person with their authorization.
Do they give you their phone password, or how'd you get online?
Oh, I held the phone to their face.
Oh, great strategy. You're like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. You're just going to go around scanning people's faces on their own phones and giving us 5-star ratings, giving us great reviews.
Do it.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Nick.
All right.
Until next time.
See you, 4 seconds.
Bye.